This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Love and Its Meaning in the World. This is Lecture 3, The Mission of Reverence, given on October 28, 1909 in Berlin, and is from the book Metamorphoses of the Soul. You are all familiar with Goethe's words that conclude his life's masterpiece, Faust. All things transient are but a parable. Earth's insufficiency here finds fulfillment. The indescribable here becomes deed. The eternal feminine draws us on high. It goes without saying that in this context, eternal feminine has nothing to do with gender. Goethe is using an ancient figure of speech. In all forms of mysticism, and Goethe gives these closing lines to a chorus mysticus, we find an urge in the soul, at first quite indefinite, toward something it has not yet come to know or to unite itself with, but must strive toward. In accord with mystics of diverse times, Goethe calls this goal, at first only dimly surmised by the aspiring soul, the eternal feminine. The whole sense of the second part of Faust confirms this meaning of the concluding lines. The chorus mysticus, with its succinct words, can be set against the unio mystica, the name true mystical thinkers give to union with the eternal feminine, far off spiritually, but within human reach. When the soul has risen to this height and feels itself to be at one with the eternal feminine, then we can speak of mystical union, and it is this summit we will be considering today. In the previous two lectures, on the mission of anger and the mission of truth, we saw that the soul is involved in a process of evolution. On the one hand, we indicated that the soul must strive to overcome certain attributes, anger, for example, which thereby can become educators of the soul. On the other hand, we saw how truth can educate the soul in its own special way. The end and goal of this process of development cannot always be foreseen by the soul. We can place some object before us and say that it has developed from an earlier form to its present stage. But we cannot say this of the human soul, for the soul is progressing through a continuing evolution where it is itself the active agent. The soul must feel that having developed to a certain point, it has to go further. And as a self-aware soul, it must say to itself, how is it that I am able to think not only about my development in the past, but also about my development in the future? Now, we have often explained how the soul, with all its inner life, is composed of three members. We cannot go over this in detail again today, but it will be better to mention it so that this lecture can be studied on its own account. We call these three members of the soul the sentient soul, the intellectual soul, and the consciousness soul. The sentient soul can live without being much permeated by thinking. Its primary role is to receive impressions from the outer world and to pass them on inwardly. It is also the vehicle of feelings, such as pleasure and pain, joy and grief, that come from these outer impressions. All human emotions, all desires, instincts, and passions arise within the sentient soul. Humankind has progressed from this stage to higher levels and has permeated the sentient soul with thinking and with feelings induced by thinking. In the intellectual soul, accordingly, we do not find indefinite feelings arising from the depths, but feelings gradually penetrated by the inner light of thought. At the same time, we find that emerging by degrees from the intellectual soul is the human I, capital, the central point of the soul that can lead to the real self, and makes it possible for us to purify, cleanse, and refine the qualities of our soul from within, so that we can become the master, leader, and guide of our volitions, feelings, and thoughts. This I, as we have seen, has two aspects. One way to develop it is through the endeavors human beings must make to strengthen this inner center more and more, so that an increasingly powerful influence can radiate from it into the environment and all the surrounding life. Enhancing the value of the soul for the surrounding world, while strengthening its independence, is one aspect of I development. The reverse side of this egoism, a self that is too weak, will lose itself in the flood of the world. But if a person likes to keep all pleasures and desires, all thinking and brooding within the I, But if a person likes to keep all pleasures and desires, all thinking and brooding within, the I will be hardened and given over to self-seeking and egoism. We have briefly described the content of the intellectual soul and have seen that wild impulses, anger, for example, can educate the soul if they are overcome and conquered. We have seen also that the intellectual soul is positively educated by truth when truth is understood as something we possess inwardly and take account of at all times, when it leads us out of ourselves and enlarges the I while strengthening it and making it more selfless. Thus we have become acquainted with the means of self-education provided for the sentient soul and the intellectual soul. Now we have to ask if a similar means is provided for the consciousness soul, the highest member of the human soul. We can also ask, what in the consciousness soul develops of its own accord, corresponding to the instincts and desires in the sentient soul? Is there something that belongs by nature to the consciousness soul, such that human beings could acquire very little of it if they were not already endowed with it? There is something that reaches out from the intellectual soul to the consciousness soul, the strength and sagacity of thinking. The consciousness soul can come to expression only because human beings are thinking beings, for its task is to acquire knowledge of the world and of itself. And for this it requires the highest instrument of knowledge, thinking. We learn about the external world through perceptions. They stimulate us to gain knowledge of our surroundings. To this end, we need only devote our attention to the outer world and not stand blankly in front of it, for then the outer world itself draws us on to satisfy our thirst for knowledge by observing it. With regard to gaining knowledge of the supersensible world, we are in a quite different situation. First of all, the supersensible world is not there in front of us. If we wish to gain knowledge of it so that this knowledge will permeate our consciousness soul, the impulse to do so must come from within and must penetrate our thinking through and through. This impulse can come only from the other powers of the soul, from feeling and willing. Unless our thinking is stimulated by both these powers, it will never be impelled to approach the supersensible world. This does not mean that the supersensible is merely a feeling, but that feeling and willing must act as inner guides toward its unknown realm. What qualities, then, must feeling and willing acquire in order to do this? First of all, someone might object to the use of a feeling as a guide to knowledge. But a simple consideration will show that, in fact, this is what feeling does. Anyone who takes knowledge seriously will admit that in acquiring knowledge we must proceed logically. We use logic as an instrument for testing the knowledge we acquire. How then, if logic is this instrument, can logic itself be proved? One might say that logic can prove itself. Yes, but before we begin proving logic by logic, it must be at least possible to grasp logic with our feeling. Logical thought cannot be proved primarily by logical thought, but only by feeling. Indeed, everything that constitutes logic is first proved by feeling, by the infallible feeling for truth that dwells in the human soul. From this classic example, we can see how feeling is the foundation of logic and of thinking. Feeling must give the impulse for the verification of thought. What must feeling become if it is to provide an impulse, not only for thinking in general, but for thinking about worlds we are at first unacquainted with and cannot survey? Feeling of this kind must be a force that strives from within toward an object yet unknown. When the human soul seeks to encompass some other thing with feeling, we call this feeling love. Love can, of course, be felt for something known, and there are many things in the world for us to love. But as love is a feeling, and as feeling is the foundation of thinking in the widest sense, we must be clear that the unknown supersensible can be grasped by feeling before thinking comes in. Accordingly, unprejudiced observation shows that it must be possible for human beings to come to love the unknown supersensible before they are able to conceive it in terms of thought. This love is indeed indispensable before the supersensible can be penetrated by the light of thought. At this stage also, the will can be permeated by a force that goes out toward the supersensible unknown. This quality of the will that enables human beings to wish to carry out their aims and intentions with regard to the unknown is devotion. So the will can inspire devotion toward the unknown, while feeling becomes love of the unknown. And when these two emotions are united, they give rise to reverence in the true sense of the word. Then devotion becomes the impulse that will lead us into the unknown, so that the unknown can be taken hold of by our thinking. Thus it is that reverence becomes the educator of the consciousness soul. For in ordinary life also we can say that when we endeavor to grasp with our thinking some external reality we do not yet know, we will be approaching it with love and devotion. The consciousness soul will never gain a knowledge of external objects unless love and devotion inspire its quest. Otherwise, the objects will not be truly observed. This also applies quite especially to all endeavors to gain knowledge of the supersensible world. In all cases, however, the soul must allow itself to be educated by the I, the source of self-awareness. We have seen how the I, capital again, still, gains increasing independence and strength by overcoming certain soul qualities, such as anger, and by cultivating others, such as the sense of truth. After that, the self-education of the I comes to an end. Its education through reverence begins. Anger is to be overcome and discarded. A sense of truth is to permeate the I. Reverence is to flow from the I toward the object one seeks to know. Thus, having raised itself out of the sentient soul and the intellectual soul by overcoming anger and other passions, and by cultivating a sense of truth, the I is drawn gradually into the consciousness soul by the influence of reverence. If this reverence becomes stronger and stronger, one can speak of it as a powerful impulse toward the realm described by Goethe. All things transient are but a parable. Earth's insufficiency here finds fulfillment. The indescribable here becomes deed. The eternal feminine draws us on high. The soul is drawn by the strength of its reverence toward the eternal, with which it longs to unite. But the I has two sides. It is impelled by necessity to enhance continually its own strength and activity. At the same time, it has the task of not allowing itself to fall under the hardening influence of egoism. If the I seeks to go further and gain knowledge of the unknown and the supersensible, and takes reverence as its guide, it is exposed to the immediate danger of losing itself. This, above all, is most likely to happen to a human being whose will is always submissive to the world. If this attitude increasingly gains the upper hand, the I may go out of itself and lose itself in the other being or thing it has submitted to. This condition can be likened to the soul fainting, as distinct from bodily fainting. When the body faints, the eye sinks into undefined darkness. When the soul faints, the eye loses itself spiritually, while the bodily faculties and perceptions of the outer world are not impaired. This can happen if the I is not strong enough to extend itself fully into the will and to guide it. This self-surrender of the I can be the final result of a systematic mortification of the will. Those who pursue this course become incapable of willing or acting on their own account. They have surrendered their will to the object of their submissive devotion and have lost their own self. When this condition prevails, it produces an enduring impotence of the soul. Only when a devotional feeling is warmed through by the I, so that one can be immersed in it without losing the I, can it be salutary for the human soul. How, then, can reverence always carry the I with it? The I, as a human self, cannot allow itself to be led in any direction unless it maintains in its thinking a knowledge of itself. Nothing else can protect the I from losing itself when devotion leads it out into the world. The soul can be led by the force of will out of itself towards something external, but when it goes beyond the limits of the external, it must be sure it is illuminated by the light of thought. Thinking itself cannot lead the soul out. This comes about through devotion. But thinking must then immediately exert itself to permeate the object of the soul's devotion with the life of thought. In other words, there must be a resolve to think about this object. As soon as the devotional impulse loses the will to think, there is a danger of losing the self. Making it a matter of principle not to think about the object of one's devotion can lead in extreme cases to a lasting debility of the soul. Is love, the other element in reverence, exposed to a similar fate? Something that radiates from the human self toward the unknown must be poured into love, so that never for a moment does the I fail to sustain itself. The I must have the will to enter everything that forms the object of its devotion, and it must maintain itself in the face of the external, the unknown, the supersensible. What becomes of love if the I fails to maintain itself at the moment of encountering the unknown, if it is unwilling to bring the light of thinking and of rational judgment to bear on the unknown? Love of that kind becomes more sentimental enthusiasm, Schwärmerei. But the I can begin to find its way from the intellectual soul, where it lives, to the external unknown, and there it can never extinguish itself altogether. Unlike the will, the I cannot completely mortify itself. When the soul seeks to embrace the external world with feeling, the I is always present in the feeling, but if it is not supported by thinking and willing, it rushes forth without restraint, unconscious of itself. And if this love for the unknown is not accompanied by resolute thinking, the soul can fall into a sentimental extreme, somewhat like sleepwalking, just as the state reached by the soul when submissive devotion leads to loss of the self is somewhat like the body fainting. When sentimental enthusiasts go forth to encounter the unknown, they leave behind the strength of the I and take along only secondary forces. Since the strength of the I is absent from their consciousness, they try to grasp the unknown as one does in the realm of dreams. Under these conditions, the soul falls into what may be called an enduring state of dreaming or somnambulism. Again, if the soul is unable to relate itself properly to the world and to other people, if it rushes out into life and shrinks from using the light of thought to illuminate its situation, then the I falls into a somnambulistic condition and is bound to go astray and to wander through the world like a will-o'-the-wisp. Only the soul that succumbs to mental laziness and shuns the light of thought when it meets the unknown will harbor superstitions in one form or another. The sentimental soul, with its fond dreams, wandering through life as though asleep, and the indolent soul, unwilling to be fully conscious of itself, are the souls most inclined to believe everything blindly. Their tendency is to avoid the effort of thinking for themselves and to allow truth and knowledge to be prescribed for them. If we are to get to know an external object, we have to bring our own productive thinking to bear on it. And it is the same with the supersensible, whatever form this may take. In seeking to gain knowledge of the supersensible, we must never exclude thinking. As soon as we rely on merely observing the supersensible, we are exposed to all possible deceptions and errors. All such errors and superstitions, all the wrong or untruthful ways of entering the supersensible worlds, can be attributed in the last instance to a refusal to allow consciousness to be illuminated by the light of creative thought. No one who has the will to always think actively and independently can be deceived by information said to come from the spiritual world. Nothing else will suffice, and every spiritual researcher will confirm this. The stronger the will to creative thinking, the greater is the possibility of gaining true, clear, and certain knowledge of the spiritual world. Thus we see the need for a means of education that will lead the eye into the consciousness soul and will guide the consciousness soul in the face of the unknown, both the physical unknown and the supersensible. Reverence, consisting of devotion and love, provides the means we seek. When devotion and love are imbued with the right kind of self-feeling, they become steps that lead to ever greater heights. True devotion, in whatever form it is experienced by the soul, whether through prayer or otherwise, can never lead anyone astray. The best way to learn to know something is to approach it first of all with love and devotion. A healthy education will consider especially how strength can be given to the development of the soul through the devotional impulse. The world is largely unknown to children. If we are to guide them toward knowledge and sound judgment of it, the best way is to awaken in them a feeling of reverence toward it. And we can be sure that by so doing, we will lead them to fullness of experience in any walk of life. It is very important for the human soul if it can look back to a childhood when devotion leading on to reverence was often felt. Frequent opportunities to look up to revered persons and to gaze with heartfelt devotion at things that are still beyond its understanding provide a good impulse for higher development in later life. People will always gratefully remember those occasions when, as children in the family circle, they heard of some outstanding personality whom everyone spoke of with devotion and reverence. A feeling of holy awe, which gives reverence and especially intimate character, will then permeate the soul. Or someone may relate how, later on, he or she rang the bell with trembling hand and shyly entered the room of the revered personality who had been spoken of with so much respectful admiration and was now being met for the first time. Simply to have come into the presence of such a person and exchanged a few words can confirm a devotion that will be particularly helpful when we are trying to unravel the great riddles of existence and are seeking the goal we long to make our own. Here, reverence is a force that draws us upward, and by so doing fortifies and invigorates the soul. How can this be? Let us consider the outward expression of reverence in human gestures. What forms does it take? We bend our knees, fold our hands, and incline our heads toward the object of our reverence. These are the organs whereby the eye, and above all the higher faculties of the soul, can express themselves most intensively. In physical life, a person stands upright by firmly extending the legs. In acts of blessing, one's eye radiates out through the hands, and by moving the head, one can observe the earth or the heavens. But from studying human nature, we learn also that our legs are stretched out at their best in strong conscious action if they have first learned to bend the knee, where reverence is really due. for this genuflection opens the door to a force that seeks to find its way into our organism. Knees that have not learned to bend in reverence give out only what they have always had. They spread out their own nullity, to which they have added nothing. But legs that have learned to genuflect receive, when they are extended, a new force, and in this not only their own nullity is what they spread around them. Hands that would feign to bless and comfort, although they have never been folded in reverence and devotion, cannot bestow much love and blessing from their own nullity. But hands that have learned to fold themselves in reverence have received a new force and are powerfully penetrated by the eye, for the path taken by this force leads first through the heart, where it kindles love. And the reverence of the folded hands, having passed through the heart and flowed into the hands, turns into blessing. The head may turn its eyes and strain its ears to survey the world in all directions, but it presents nothing but its own emptiness. If, however, the head has been bent in reverence, it gains a new force. It will bring the feelings it has acquired through reverence to meet the outer world. Anyone who studies the gestures of people and knows what they signify will see how reverence is expressed in external physiognomy and how it enhances the strength of the eye, making it possible for the eye to penetrate into the unknown. Moreover, this self-education through reverence has the effect of raising to the surface our obscure instincts and emotions, our sympathies and antipathies, which otherwise make their way into the soul unconsciously or subconsciously, unchallenged by the light of judgment. Precisely these feelings are cleansed and purified through self-education, by reverence, and through the penetration by the eye of the higher members of the soul. The obscure forces of sympathy and antipathy, always prone to error, are permeated by the light of the soul and transformed into judgment, aesthetic taste, and rightly guided moral feeling. A soul educated by reverence will convert its dark cravings and aversions into a feeling for the beautiful and a feeling for the good. A soul that has cleansed its obscure instincts and will impulses through devotion will gradually build up from them what we call moral ideals. Reverence is something that we plant in the soul as a seed, and the seed will bear fruit. Human life offers yet another example. We see everywhere that the course of a human life goes through ascending and declining stages. Childhood and youth are stages of ascent. Then comes a pause, and finally, in the later years, a decline. Now, the remarkable thing is that the qualities acquired in childhood and youth reappear in a different form during the years of decline. If much reverence, rightly guided, has been part of the experience of childhood, it acts as a seed that comes to fruition in old age, as strength for active living. If devotion and love were not fostered under the right guidance during childhood and youth, it leads to a weak and powerless old age. Reverence must take hold of every soul that is to make progress in its development. How is it, then, with the corresponding quality in the object of our reverence? If we look with love on another being, then the reciprocated love of the latter will reveal what can perhaps arise. If we are lovingly devoted to our God, we can be sure that God inclines to us also in love. Reverence is the feeling we develop for whatever we call God out there in the universe. Since the reaction to reverence cannot itself be called reverence, we may not speak of a divine reverence toward humans. What, then, is precisely the opposite of reverence in this context? What is it that flows out to meet reverence when reverence seeks the divine? It is might, the almighty power of the divine. Reverence that we learn to feel in youth returns to us as strength for living in old age. And if we turn in reverence to the divine, our reverence flows back to us as an experience of the almighty. That is what we feel, whether we look up to the starry heavens in their endless glory, and our reverence goes out to all that lies around us, beyond our compass, or whether we look up to our invisible God, in whatever form, who pervades and animates the cosmos. We look up toward the Almighty and come to feel with certainty that we cannot advance toward union with what is above us unless we first approach it from below with reverence. We draw nearer to the Almighty when we immerse ourselves in reverence. Thus we can speak of an Almighty in this sense, while a true feeling for the meaning of words prevents us from speaking of an all-loving. Power can be increased or enhanced in proportion to the number of beings over which it extends. It is different with love. If a child is loved by its mother, this does not prevent her from loving equally her second, third, or fourth child. It is false for anyone to say, "I must divide up my love because it is to cover two objects." It is false to speak either of an all-knowledge or an indefinite all-love. Love has no degree and cannot be limited by figures. Love and devotion together make up reverence. We can have a devoted attitude to this or that unknown if we have the right feeling for it. Devotion can be enhanced, but it does not have to be divided up or multiplied when it is felt for a number of beings. Since this is true also of love, the eye has no need to lose or disperse itself if it turns with love and devotion toward the unknown. Love and devotion are thus the right guides to the unknown and the best educators of the soul in its advance from the intellectual soul to the consciousness soul. Whereas overcoming anger educates the sentient soul and striving for truth educates the intellectual soul, reverence educates the consciousness soul, bringing more and more knowledge within its reach. But this reverence must be led and guided from a standpoint that never shuts out the light of thought. When love flows forth from us, it ensures by its own worth that our self can go with it, and this applies also to devotion. We could indeed lose our self, but we need not. That is the point, and it must be kept especially in mind if an impulse of reverence enters the education of the young. A blind, unconscious reverence is never right. Cultivating reverence must go together with cultivating a healthy I feeling. Whereas the mystics of all ages, together with Goethe, have spoken of the unknown, undefined element to which the soul is drawn, as the eternal feminine, we may, without misunderstanding, speak of the element that must always animate reverence as the eternal masculine. For just as the eternal feminine is present in both man and woman, so is this eternal masculine, this healthy I feeling, present in all reverence by man or woman. And when Goethe's Chorus Mysticus comes before us, we may, having come to know the mission of reverence that leads us toward the unknown, add the element that must permeate all reverence, the eternal masculine. Thus we are now able to reach a right understanding of the experience of the human soul when it strives to unite itself with the unknown and attains to the unio mystica, wherein all reverence is consummated. But this mystical union will harm the soul if the I is lost while seeking to unite itself with the unknown in any form. If the I has lost itself, it will bring to the unknown nothing of value. Self-sacrifice in the unio mystica requires that one must have become something, must have something to sacrifice. If a weak I, with no strength in itself, is united with what lies above us, the union has no value. The unio mystica has value only when a strong I ascends to the region spoken of by the Chorus Mysticus. Then when Goethe speaks of the regions to which the higher reverence can lead us, in order to gain the highest knowledge. And when this Chorus Mysticus tells us in the beautiful words, "All things transient are but a parable. Earth's insufficiency here finds fulfillment. The indescribable here becomes deed. The eternal feminine draws us on high." If we understand the Unio Mystica correctly, we can reply, yes, all things transient are but a parable. Earth's insufficiency here finds fulfillment. The indescribable here becomes deed. The eternal masculine draws us on high. The end of part 3.